Welcome to the August 20th, 2012 teleconference, and our guest today is Jim Autry, author of The Servant Leader, and I'll give you more details about his background in a minute. But we'd like to start these with a quick check-in for people who are on the call, just to say who you are and where you're calling from. So anyone can start.
Hi, this is Terry Clark. I'm with Cardno Entrix, an environmental water resources consulting company in South Florida.
Thanks, Terry.
Peggy O'Neill, Fort Smith, Arkansas.
Hi, Peggy. I'm glad you got in.
Yeah.
This is Portia. I'm calling from Cleveland, Ohio.
Hi, Portia. Oh, you got in, too. Terrific.
I'm Greg Kirby. I'm in Augusta, Georgia. And I'm with actually several firms, Kirby Farron and Associates and Quantum Fitness of Evans.
Great, Greg. Thank you. Is there anyone else? Okay. So other people will be joining us as the call unfolds, and we will what I'm going to be doing is putting you on mute during the time that I'm asking Jim Autry some questions, and then we'll open it up for questions and dialogue afterwards. So let me go ahead and turn that on. And I'd like to begin with a poem, and you'll learn a little bit more about what a poet Jim is, I hope. But there's a poem in his book, The Servant Leader, and it's titled Recessions. And when he wrote this, Jim, that would have been about 2001, I think.
Yeah,
recessions was probably the furthest thing from anyone's mind at that point. But it seemed like you had a sense, probably because you've lived through them before, of what that experience is like. And so I'd like to share this poem. Why do we keep on keeping on in the midst of such pressure? When business is no good for no reason, when everything done right turns out wrong, when the Fed does something and interest rates do something and somebody's notion of consumer confidence does something and the dogs won't eat the dog food. What keeps us working late at night and going back every morning, living on coffee and waiting for things to bottom out, crunching numbers as if some answer lay buried in a computer and not out among the people who suddenly and for no reason are leaving their money in their pocket and the product on the shelves? Why don't we just say to hell with it instead of trying again, instead of meandering into someone's office with half an idea, hoping she'll have the other half, hoping what sometimes happens will happen, that thing, that click, that moment when two or three of us gathered together or hanging out get hit by something we've never tried, but we know we can make it work the first time. Could that be it? That we do all the dull stuff just for those times, when a revelation rises among us like something burning, a new life, another hope, like something not visible catching the sun, like a prayer answered. Please join me in a moment of silence. Thank you so much. I'd like to introduce Jim Autry now and feel just such a great privilege, Jim, to have you on this call and a part of our Wisdom at Work conference. Jim is a former Fortune 500 executive. He's an author of 11 books, a poet, a management consultant, and an executive coach. And he's worked with a variety of companies and CEOs. His book, Love and Profit, The Art of Caring Leadership, a collection of essays and poetry, won the prestigious Johnson, Smith & Nisley Award as the book that had the most impact on executive thinking in 1992. That book also, by the way, has been used in a number of courses on leadership as a textbook. Before taking early retirement in 1991, Jim was pursuing, I'm sorry, before he took early retirement in 1991 to pursue his present career, Jim had a distinguished career at Meredith Corporation, where he was senior vice president and president of its magazine group. Jim has also been very active in many civic and charitable organizations, and most notably has worked with disability rights groups for 30 years. Other involvement has included his work with the Epilepsy Foundation of America, the National Advisory Committee of the White House Conference on Families, the Des Moines Symphony, which is where he lives in Des Moines, Iowa, and others. He's a founder of the Des Moines National Poetry Festival, and his writings are noted for their mixture of prose and poetry in addressing the issues of leadership and management and spirit. And so, Jim, again, welcome. Thank you so much for being on this teleconference and being my guest once again on a teleconference series. I've loved having the chance to touch in with you from time to time over the years and connect and be inspired by you and the work you're doing.
Well, I couldn't be happier than to be on the call and to be in touch with you again, Judy. We sort of went our own ways for a few years. I kept up with you through mutual friends and other ways, but I'm happy to be involved with this and looking forward to being part of the conference.
Yeah, I'm excited about that, too. For everyone's information, the conference we're talking about is the 2012 Wisdom at Work Conference here at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, Arkansas. And the dates of that conference are October 31st and November 1st. And Jim is one of five keynote speakers. And we'll be talking about servant leadership, putting the theory to work. And so I want to start by asking you, Jim, when and how did you first get interested in servant leadership?
Look, it probably started with the book Love and Profit, The Art of Caring Leadership. I was calling it Caring Leadership and had written and spoken on that quite a bit. And the folks at the Greenleaf Center for Servant Leadership contacted me and said, "You're really talking about servant leadership." I was aware of servant leadership and the parallels, but I hadn't really used the term because I hadn't done enough study about Dr. Greenleaf's work. Well, I've set about getting myself caught up on that and decided that servant leadership could be a movement even, whereas caring leadership was likely not. So I guess you could say I jumped onto the servant leadership movement and have been working with that for several years now. I wrote the book, The Servant Leader, some years ago at the request of a publisher, and it's done very well and has become a book used in a lot of classes. You talked about the Love and Profit, but this book, The Servant Leader, has been used in quite a lot of classes. And I found myself doing servant leader workshops in Iceland and Singapore and Australia, Canada, Nassau, the Netherlands, where I helped write the curriculum for Servant Leadership Academy. So that it sort of, once I got into it, it sort of blossomed for me and I for it.
Right, it really does sound like a movement from...
Yeah, I'm proud to say that I introduced servant leadership to Starbucks and some other mm-hmm. companies, so it's...
And you write about that in the book, too.
I hope it's a movement.
I do, too. I know here in Arkansas, where we've got the corporate headquarters for Walmart, and yeah, that's the largest corporation in the world, and they're... culture is based on a servant leader approach, and they've instituted servant leadership training programs over the years quite a bit, and many of the vendors have also taken up on it because of what they have learned from using servant leadership. So it really feels like a movement to me. But let me back up and back up before servant leadership and before you started writing Caring Leadership. You know, back in the early 90s when you were using words like care and love, that was really radical. It's still radical. But why were you called to that? What was that about for you?
Well, I think it came about because I had a very fine mentor, the CEO of Meredith. He's the first man I heard use the word love in the context of business. We were looking at a company that was really having a lot of trouble. He had just taken over, and he was talking about the elements of self-renewal. And he said, love is a central element of self-renewal. Love of one another, of the work we do, of the people we work with. And it just was, it was like an epiphany for me. And it was also permission to use words I was comfortable with but had not been comfortable with in the context of business. So I began to write some poetry and some essays. And I felt that poetry might be the best means for getting at the emotion of management and the emotion of leadership. You know, we're tough guys. We don't like to talk about how much it hurts when you have to discipline someone, when you have to fire someone, how much it hurts when an employee says, I have cancer, but I've still got to employ the policies, the sick leave policies and all the structural things. So I decided that I'd try to put some vocabulary into that emotion. And that led to a proposal from my agent that we do a book. And I turned a book into essays and poetry called, you know, Love and Profit. But I was using it in my work and with the people, partly because it's natural with me. I did not have a business degree. And I didn't study business. A lot of my friends would say, well, that's pretty obvious. So I was more in journalism and liberal arts, and so those vocabularies were more comfortable for me, and I just used them. I talked about caring for one another, talked about looking out for one another. You know, I used that line that we have to love what we do and love the people we do it with. Mm-hmm. So I sort of transitioned into it after being shocked by the CEO's use of the word love and taking that as permission.
And just think about how many people he touched, and then hopefully how many people you've touched and inspired as the kind of rippling out effect of his inspiration. That's really beautiful. I want to ask you about... Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say we're both retired from Meredith, but he and I are still friends.
Yeah. Because there's that connection of love.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that you do is that I had never seen anybody else do is you make a distinction when you talk about servant leaders. You make a distinction between workplace spirituality, your spirituality in the workplace, and your personal spirituality. What is that distinction about? Can you say more?
Yeah, well, it's not so much trying to make a distinction, but between spiritualities as it is to use vocabularies that assure that my work, my writing, my speaking about the workplace remains non-sectarian. It's too easy to fall into, you know, either Christian talk or Jewish talk or Buddhist talk and make that sort of the center of the conversation. I want to talk about how a life that is centered, an inner life that is centered, and that brings the issue, matters of the spirit into the way I think about my work. I want to talk about that. It's not that I want to try to proselytize people. I don't want to try to make anybody else spiritual if they're not moved to the spirit. But I want to use it so that I'm comfortable with it and that people who read it and listen to me are also comfortable with it. When I first started talking about this, Judy, it was a pretty delicate path to walk. I mean, no one talked about spirituality at work except a few of my friends whom you know on the West Coast. I wanted to find a way to do it that people of all faiths or no faith, that people who were sort of hard-nosed, top-down, command-control business people or people who were more servant leaders would respond to and respect. And I think for the most part I've been successful at that. Was that a Did I answer your question?
Yes, very much. Thank you. And could you say a little bit about how you define spirituality in the workplace? I mean, you've talked about it as being inclusive. What does it really mean for you?
Well, it means for me, personally, it means for me to always be open to the divine in others, to look for the divine in other people, to realize that spirituality and that connection with the divine is acted out through other people. And that's me personally, but when I talk about the spirituality in the workplace, I talk about the community of work, the connection that we all have in the community of work. We depend on one another, we care about one another, we support one another, because what we're doing together is dependent upon one another. To me, that feeling of community is a manifestation of the spirit at work, and that's the way I put it.
Mm-hmm. I just came back from the Academy of Management Conference in Boston, and we have a special interest group called the Management Spirituality and Religion Special Interest Group, where scholars come together to share their research on spirituality in the workplace. And the thing that I noticed when people defined it, the one word that kept coming up over and over again was connection.
Yes.
And I love Ken Wilber's definition that he talks about transcendent connection or vertical connection, you know, connection to the divine, and a horizontal connection, which is a connection to each other, to the planet, to those that we serve. And that the holistic spirituality is one that incorporates both.
I'm familiar with Ken Wilber's work.
Yeah, well, it sounds like you line right up with it. So what could you tell us about your own spiritual path?
Well, it hasn't been smooth.
Were you raised in a religious tradition?
Yes, my father and my grandfather were both Southern Baptist ministers in Mississippi. I grew up in a very Southern Baptist fundamentalist church and upbringing, and I have no doubt that that did me a lot of good. As I moved to a more, let's use the word transcendent view of religion generally and spirituality, I moved away from that and into more what's called progressive Christian church. I'm a member of UCC, United Churches of Christ, which is a pretty progressive / liberal group. My Unitarian friends say, UCC, oh yes, that's Unitarians considering Christ. they josh about it. But concomitant with that religious path is also another aspect of the spiritual path, which I got on through becoming acquainted with really wonderful people, you probably know them all, and was led to considerations of Eastern philosophy and Eastern religions, and I got very interested in the mystic poets, and not just the Eastern mystics, but the Christian mystics and the Jewish mystics. And that informed me a lot. That informed my spirituality. That made me feel a deeper spirit connection with people of other faiths, with mystics, and led me into things like meditation and centering prayer, mm-hmm. and things which continue to inform my spiritual path. So, you know, I've told people this, and I'm always amazed how many people, including one of the ministers at our church, who started out just the way I did and took a somewhat parallel path. But that's it in a nutshell, Judy.
Well, thank you. You're reminding me of something a friend of mine, Alan Harpum, said, that when he went to an interfaith religious conference that where people from traditions all over the world came to share their commitment to interfaith dialogue. And he said it was so amazing to see most people continuing to stay in their own group with their own people that they were comfortable with because of their religious background. But he said the mystics from each tradition found each other immediately.
Yes.
And they're the ones that felt like they spoke the most common language. So it did. It transcended the boundaries of the particular religion because it gets back to the source of the experience of the transcendent. Yeah.
I just heard a lecture on that very subject.
I'd love to hear information about that. We can do that offline. Thank you. So I want to get back to the book and hopefully some of the things you'll be talking about when you're at our conference. And one of the things you write about is the difference between doing and being for a servant leader. And you describe five ways of being and talk about the importance of being and where that comes from, the source. And those five ways are being authentic, or you say be, not being, but be authentic, be vulnerable, be accepting, be present, and be useful. Can you give us just like a real brief description, because I want to turn this conversation over to other people shortly, but just kind of the headlines on these five ways of being.
Sort of my interpretation of sort of the principles of Robert Greenleaf and servant leadership, and also my experience and what really is required from a leader in the workplace, a servant leader. I mean, it all starts with being a servant first, but to be authentic simply means to be who you are. And I see so many people in leadership positions who try to be who they are expected to be by others rather than who they are. That's really quick. But being vulnerable, that doesn't mean, you know, breaking down and crying at a moment's notice, although that's okay, but being willing to admit errors and mistakes and listen to other ways of doing things, even from people who may report to you, that's part of being vulnerable. But being willing to accept, to say, you know, I was wrong when you were wrong, and no matter if that may be to someone who works for you, just to say I was wrong about that. I often say the four most powerful words in leadership are, I could be wrong. Be vulnerable. I said that. Be accepting. You know, we organize in teams, and one of the interesting things about teams in my work with companies is that I'll ask how many of you on a team get a lot of, how many of you on a team where you never have any conflict and no hands go up. But people expect there to be no conflict, and teams very often get into trouble because they don't accept one another's viewpoints. They don't accept differences. They'll say, well, she's not a team player, when actually she may have a terrific idea because nobody wants to hear it. I always say that acceptance is more important than approval, and I think that's true in friendship and parenting and marriages, any sort of relationship. Acceptance is more important than approval. Be present. That's a lot more important these days than people think it is. With social media and with all the email and all the distractions, being present is ever more challenging. Have you gone into someone's office where you walk in there and they're on the phone, they're looking at the computer, and they look up and they say, you know, I got to take this call, I'll just be a minute, and they check their email while they're waiting? That is not being present, and it is very negative in its images and its messages to the people who are trying to get your attention. Being present means putting all distractions aside, making eye contact, and being there with your full self. And being useful simply means that. Work at being a servant. Work at trying to help people. The point is to help people be the best they can be at what they're doing, and to serve them, give them the resources, the support, the direction often, the correction sometimes, but trying to help them always be the best people they can be and the best workers they can be. So that's it quickly, Judy.
Thank you. I hope that entices people to want to learn more from you about the actual approach of beingness in the workplace, because hardly anybody talks about that except for those of us in the spirituality in the workplace movement and wisdom at work and servant leadership. But most people just don't talk about being or presence. And so for someone like you who's worked in the corporate world and had an executive position, I think your words carry a lot of weight and can be very inspiring to people who basically want to break out of the shell that they feel is imposed on them by other people's expectations.
I hope so. What I like to say is servant leadership is not about what you do. It's about what other people do because you're there.
Mm. Yeah, that's really making a difference, just through presence. So I'm just going to ask you a couple more questions. And one of them is, you know, in your book, the book I'm talking about right now is Servant Leader. You have many books. But in the Servant Leader, the most of the book is nuts and bolts and talks about hard organizational realities. And it's clear that you're not talking from an academic or kind of theological perspective, although there's underpinnings of that there. You're talking about the real lived experience of people in the workplace and how they can be more of a servant leader, regardless of their role. So can you give us one or two examples of kind of the hard realities and what you recommend?
Well, when I was asked to write this book, it was by a division of Random House, and the editor said, we have a terrific book that's done well called The Servant by Jim Hunter, and we'd like a follow-up book to it on servant leadership. And I said, look, the world does not need another book on servant leadership that's all up in the ether. You know, if I'm going to write a book, I want to write something on what you have to do every day. What are the challenges? When do you have to fire people? What if you get sued? All of that. How does a servant leader deal with those things? So they gave me the go-ahead, and basically, Judy, that's the book. The first two chapters are set the stage and are somewhat philosophical, and the whole rest of the book is about things like tools of the trade. It surprises people that I like things like performance appraisals and performance standards and job descriptions and all those things which sound so corporate. But those used by the servant leader, those are just tools for good communication and to achieve clarity with people.
And expressions of caring.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Can you give us one example? Like, for instance, a year ago I was sued, and it was a nightmare. And so if a company is sued and it's because of something you as a leader did or didn't do, but at least someone's claiming that, well, how might a servant leader approach that?
Being sued?
Yeah.
Well, what I say about being sued is that starting one, you're going to be sued. I mean, you're just going to be sued.
Just accept it.
Yeah, accept it. If you're going to be in organizational life, the chances are you're going to get sued. You can take the viewpoint, as I do, that rather than being nuisances and costly, lawsuits are one of the great gifts of our society and our way of governing. They may be irritating, some of them may be frivolous, and believe me, they're abuses, but basically, they are aimed at equity and justice. So when I've been sued, I thought, well, I think the person is wrong, but I'm not going to demonize that person. And I think that the important attitude is to realize that these things are not personal. And the big mistake that people of all stripes, but I'm saying particular leaders and managers and companies, do is make these personal issues, which means you respond often with anger and demonizing the other person. When I've been sued, I've sometimes frustrated the lawyers because I don't mind standing outside the courtroom talking with the person who is suing us. It seems to me that that the best thing you can do is adopt an attitude of cooperation in the process without abandoning your position legally, and also an attitude of this is all part of the organizational dance that we all have to do. Sometimes it's irritating and debilitating, but basically, it's part of a process that works for us and is fundamentally pretty good. So a lot of it is attitude. And then from a,
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that last line. A lot of it's attitude.
You need to cooperate and provide what you're asked to provide.
Yeah.
But realistically, you have to provide not one sentence more than they ask you to provide. You have to be smart, but you can't be combative. That gets you in trouble, being combative.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's one of the, I mean, it's, you talk about conflict, and this is just kind of conflict on steroids when it gets to the lawsuits. Stage, but it's that attitude of real respect and caring for the other, even if they disagree in some way with you or take action against you. Can you, from a spiritual perspective, still maintain that open heart and that vulnerability and that caring?
We have in our society, Judy, and it's, I think, much more intense and troubling than it ever was. We no longer seem to respect our adversaries. I mean, we can have differences of opinion, but we should respect other people's viewpoint, even if we adamantly oppose them. But rather than that, we are turning to anger and hostility. One of the reasons I wrote my new book, about gratitude, choosing gratitude, is trying to do something to get past all the anger and hostility.
Yeah, there's so much polarity. I mean, we see that in the political system most blatantly, but there's all kinds of polarity that we just, so many of us long to bridge. And I do want to highlight, I haven't finished reading all of Choosing Gratitude yet, but I'm about halfway through. And I find that, just so I recommend this to others on the call, I find that it changes moment to moment things that I see around me and people I see around me. It's a real consciousness raising book, and I'm grateful you wrote it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Judy. I appreciate it.
So I have one more question, just a short one, and then we'll open this up for other people to participate. What do you hope to have come out of the Wisdom at Work conference? I'm grateful you accepted my invitation to come and speak to us. And what's your vision of this conference?
Well, I guess my vision for the conference would parallel yours, and I hope that people will come away somewhat transformed in the way they look at the workplace and their own inner life in relation to the workplace. Second thing, frankly, is I'm looking forward to learning a lot there from, I don't know if I can pronounce these names, but Dr. Delbecq and Dr. Omet, Dr. Malik, Dr. Linson. Mm-hmm. I think this is going to be a wonderful privilege and gift to me that I'm able to go there and listen to these eminent folks and learn a lot. And as you know, everything is material for a writer.
Yeah, bring your notepad. There's going to be lots to write about. And we're just going to love having you as a participant in all the different sessions and really look forward to your keynote. So let's go ahead and open up the conversation to other people on the call. And it's now open if anyone would like to ask a question or make a comment. And just please say your name first.
Please don't everybody speak at one time.
Well, I can always call on people. And let me do that for a minute. Kay Bernard, you've joined the call, and I just want to make sure that the way I'm managing the phone call is working properly. Kay, can you say hello and say a little bit about the Center for Servant Leadership that we have here in Northwest Arkansas?
Okay. Hi, this is Kay Bernard, and I am the administrator for a servant leadership school that we have here, and pretty much what I just joined the call, and I was late getting home to do this, but what I heard was that we try to come to our lives in a transformative way, and that's what James was talking about, hoping that this conference could provide. And I do believe that what we provide here at the Servant Leadership School is a venue for people to really look at themselves, at the world around them, and the point of view that we carry towards each day of our lives. And if and this was developed in a church in Greensboro, North Carolina, and put together over a period of 22 years, the curriculum that we use. So it is Christian-based, but we use Jesus as a model of servant leadership, because I think he was the ultimate model. But, you know, it's open to everyone, and it's not something that we're, you know, beating Christianity, you know, around with. It's something that we just use as our model. So if any of you are in this area, we'd love to have you come and participate. It's a great course. Judy's been through almost everything we've offered.
Yeah, I even offered a course myself on calling, thanks
That's right.
to your support.
That's right, she did.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Great to have you on the call, Kay. So if people want to look up the Servant Leadership School, the St. Paul's website would be the best way to do that?
That's correct. St. Paul's, Fay, FAY.org.
Great, thank you. Kay, while I've got you, do you have a question or a comment for Jim?
I guess the question that I would have is, once you open yourself to the concept of being a servant leader and approaching your life differently, how does one, how would he propose that one take this out into the everyday world, especially in organizations or corporations that someone may be in? How can this be a practical thing? In our course, we teach having practices so that you can come out to the world each morning. When you wake up, you come out a little bit kinder and gentler. What would James's approach be for that?
Are you asking how to take it into the workplace?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it does begin, as you've said, with working on yourself. I've always said that you can work hard at being the kind of person you want to be, then you'll be the leader you want to be. I think that, I don't know what your practices are, but there are all sorts of things that I talk about, like centering prayer and meditation. And
mm-hmm. That's what we propose to.
Leave those sorts of spiritual disciplines
mm-hmm.
are important to bring people into, I call it a connection with their own inner life
mm-hmm.
that then manifests as behavior. When it gets into the workplace, it is behavior that is impresses the other people. I mean, people, they can't know how you feel. They can only know what you do. And so what you do is based on who you are. So I'm saying, in order to be able to bring about the right result in the workplace, and it starts with who you are. It's being and not doing. But that being does manifest itself as behavior. That behavior I've detailed as being, even though it's being, it arises out of being authentic and demonstrating that. In other words, doing what you say you're going to do is one measure of authenticity. Being vulnerable, one measure of that is being willing to admit your mistakes. So those things are the way that the inner work is acted out for others. Am I making myself clear?
You are. As a matter of fact, you're kind of affirming what we are doing. Wouldn't you say, Judy?
Oh, very definitely.
That's exactly what we propose. What you're talking about, is this in this new book, Choosing Gratitude?
Well, Choosing Gratitude
servant leader
is,
book.
I like to say that the great poet of plays, William Stafford, said that the writer's work is to dig so deep into his own story that he reaches everybody's story.
Mm-hmm.
Choosing Gratitude is very much my story of the everyday things, some small, some large, for which I'm grateful, and how I came to that through a meditative experience that I call my gratitude walk. But it's not an advice book in any way. It's a personal storybook that I hope demonstrates ways that other people can begin to look at the world and feel gratitude rather than all the hostility and anger and the polarization we have. But Judy, you've read part of the book. Maybe you could amplify what I've said or augment it.
I think I would just agree that that it's a very personal book and universal, because your stories, like your stories about your daughter and the gratitude you have for her and people who've helped her, you know, it's very, very personal. And or even the vacation from hell that you describe and all the people who helped on that. I think it's things that we all can relate to, and it's a beautiful model of seeing how you can be grateful in the midst of very difficult situations. And so it's inspiring in that way. I think Kay's question about kind of the practical application of servant leadership and spirituality in the workplace, I find just the whole book of Servant Leader is really chock full of extremely specific practical examples, and again, some inspiring stories. And particularly what you wrote about Starbucks and your work with Starbucks, because in a way it kind of walks people through what's possible when a culture adapts a servant leadership attitude or mindset.
I think I also wrote a section in there about when you have to lay off people and how took one company through that in a servant leader way.
And, Jim, you'll love it when you get a chance to meet Robert Wimet, another one of our keynote speakers, because he talks about a particular layoff approach that they take in their company that usually blows people out of the water, and how loving and caring and courageous it is in the way that they reach out to people that they have to lay off. And so you, the two of you will have a wonderful time sharing stories about the ways you approach things.
The wonderful thing about Starbucks and Southwest Airlines and Men's Warehouse and TD Industries and some of those big companies being servant leader companies is they sort of give me the resources to answer people who say, well, I'm in a publicly held corporation, I can't do all this. You know, the stock market will eat me up if I do it.
Wrong.
But it gives me some good resources for saying it can be done. It is being done in companies of all sizes.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Let's see if someone else has a question or a comment.
Peggy O'Neill. And, Jim, who do you find is attracted to your work? You mentioned some specifics there, but can you describe people who come and say, I want to work with you, or help me become a servant leader?
Well, I usually do that in groups, although I've done a good deal of individual counseling of executives who wanted to be on the servant leader road and tried to do it and really needed some kind of tuning up. In fact, getting with them on specific personnel challenges mostly and telling them how to handle that as a servant leader. But most of what I do is in groups, in lectures and workshops. And frankly, I do things that surprise people. I don't talk about organizational life. My workshops focus on personal growth. I have people telling, for instance, I'll talk about the hero's journey. Everybody knows the hero's journey. And then split the group up into pairs and have each one tell your story. I say, tell your story to your colleague there. Tell your story as a hero story, at which you are the hero. And then after that, tell your story as a victim story, at which you are the victim. And I'm trying to get people to identify with the deep things that have motivated them or failed to motivate them in their lives. We do something I call the poetry bazaar, where we have 100 pages of things and writings of various sorts, and have the people just walk around to the tables, pick something that speaks to them, take it back to their seat, and then, on a voluntary basis, stand up and read what you picked and tell us what it means to you. How did it speak to you? So it's a lot about tuning people into their inner life and their emotional life rather than their management life.
But for these groups, is this like a public program, or if it's a corporate program, what sort of corporate leader are you finding comes to?
Well, I've mainly done it with corporate programs, and it's for corporate leaders who want to do servant leadership. They want to inculcate it into themselves and their company, and basically a management group. I mostly have worked with managers.
So there's no way to, I mean, it's not, there's no way to describe a type of person that tends to come to you.
I could describe the type of people who don't tend to come to me.
Oh, okay.
So you'll kick them in the rear and take names, you know, top down. We got to get organized around here sort of people. I don't get people from the automotive industry or the oil industry. There are not many from the financial services industry. There are not a lot of Wall Streeters beating on my door.
Uh-huh.
But people in the businesses that depend on interaction with other people, whether the employees or customers, to be successful, that's where I have done most of my work and I think have been most successful at it. That would include people like Starbucks and Southwest Airlines.
Yeah, okay. Well, thank you very much, Jim.
Welcome.
Hi. Oh, go ahead, Portia. I'm sorry.
Yeah, and thank you, because I kind of wanted to piggyback on what Peggy was saying. My question was around the demographics as well. I've done work in the World Bank in conflict countries where it's politically unstable, leadership effectiveness, organizational effectiveness, and what I have found was that, and I worked at the leadership level and at the teams level and then the broader, the higher organizational level as well, and the client is typically the manager, the executive, and they'll ask for something in particular, and of course they'll need more than what they ask for. But what I began to find was when I would walk into a room, even before I introduced myself, members of the team would say, please don't have us do the same thing that we've been doing. And the team, the staff level, they were very open and desirous and, you know, pleading for something along these lines. It took a little longer, or sometimes a lot longer, for the folks in leadership to get to the level of, let's say, transformational leader. Maybe they were at like transitional phase. They could understand doing work for the public good, but not operating on a higher level for a higher purpose. So I'm just wondering, Jim, when you walk into a place, and I hear that you work with groups and also some executives, and there are some people that are obviously attuned to what you're doing at different levels, different teams, what was it like?
Well, first, if I walk into a group like you, I don't know what's going on, what's happened, how they are. I usually open with sort of a basic talk about servant leadership, but then I figure what I need to do is try to figure out if there's a pathology here, mm-hmm. and if so, what is it? Mm-hmm. And I use the Peter Senge technique of undiscussables, and I do it anonymously. I take these sheets of paper, I say, look, on these sheets of paper, you write the things that you think we don't talk about around here that we should talk about. What do we not discuss we ought to discuss? And just write as many of those as you want and pass them up here. And then I promise to eat them when I'm done so they'll remain anonymous. And I just read them one at a time, quietly and rather slowly. I read them one at a time. Obviously, they fall in patterns. And the pathology of the organization reveals itself so dramatically. It's breathtaking sometimes. And that creates within the top people a certain shock value. They have no idea that their people are feeling this way. They have no idea this is what's going on in their organization. And that sort of sets the stage then for doing some work in which we, you know, try to just be honest with one another. And I will often then go into what I call the circles of silence, in which we use silence and speak, you know, from our experience. I've described that in the book, too. The the leaders are sometimes shocked. I mean, more often than not shocked. In fact, I worked with a large music group on the West Coast about 3 years ago, and the CEO afterwards stood up and went and pulled me aside and wanted to go in with his boss and resign. He wanted to resign to the board. I said, absolutely not. But you've learned a valuable lesson. You're wasting this lesson if you give up. This is the time to do something. Well, he actually worked with that company, and today that's a terrific model of a servant leadership company. They just turned right around as a result of this one exercise. It's almost like diagnosing a disease. Once you get it diagnosed, you can deal with it. But until you diagnose it, you can't deal with it. So that's one of the things. I'm going on too long here, but it's a process, and frankly, I have to deal with it intuitively.
I just wanted to let you know that Portia is going to be at the conference. So, Portia, you and Jim can also follow up further, and Peggy will be too. They're both presenters at the conference. And so this is a delight because you'll all get to meet face-to-face in a couple of months. I'm sorry, who wanted to go next? Someone was making a comment.
I was just going to make a brief comment, and actually is someone I think before me with a longer question. But Jim, I just wanted you to repeat, when you ask people to talk about the things that are not said, what's the specific thing you're asking them to talk about?
Specifically, I'm saying, if this organization is like every other organization I've ever visited, there are a whole lot of things we don't talk about. We'd like to talk about them, but those are things we just don't talk about around here. They're just not discussable, and yet they ought to be. So write down the things you think that the group should discuss that nobody talks about.
Okay, thank you very much. I'll come back with a question, but I think there was someone before me in the queue.
Okay.
I don't think there is, actually. I think you should go ahead.
Okay. Well, so,
and who is this that's speaking?
My name is Tony Lennart. I've actually been working in Africa for about 12 years and basically teaching leadership to not only some of the top corporate leaders, but also some of the top leaders in government and also rebels, teaching them to think differently and teaching them to be... I wouldn't say that I'm teaching... Actually, to some degree, I am teaching even the rebels to be servant leaders.
Good for you.
Thank God for you.
Yeah.
And fortunately, I'm still alive. but basically, yeah, through teaching them to be best leaders and be more successful, but then having them recognize that it is about the personal development. It is about having, you know, a sense of meaning, and that the aspects that lead to good performance are the aspects that also lead to them having a good life and also being a better person. Yeah. Then, you know, that does make quite a difference. There was a Christian lady on earlier, so I'll just share one exercise I did with them. A lot of them said they were Christians. I'm talking here about a group of about 176 rebels in Congo. They had been the main participants in a conflict that's cost about 5 million lives. But I challenged them and I said, what would a Christian rebel look like? And basically the answer was someone who kills as few people as possible. But anyway, I don't want to talk too much about
myself.
You're
going to be at the conference? I'd love to meet you.
No, I'm in Australia at the moment. And I've spent a pretty huge amount of money doing the work, so I'm in the mode of bringing back the money into my life. So flying over would be a little difficult, but maybe in a future year, I would certainly love to come.
Okay, well, it's good to hear from you. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Jim, why don't you give people your email and your website so that if anyone wants to follow up with you, I'm sure you're open to continued conversations.
I am. I don't respond really on my website very much, but the website is simple. It's www.jamesaautry.com. Don't leave out the middle A. Looks funny, the two A's together, jamesaautry.com. My email address, and I'd be happy to hear from you, is jautrydsm, J-A-U-T-R-Y, D as in David, S as in Sierra, M as in Metro. That's the DSM is the airport designation for Des Moines, at AOL.com, jautrydsm@AOL.com.
Okay. So The question that I had is that now that I've come back to Australia, I'm noticing so many people that don't really feel connected to their work, and a lot of this very top-down management. And what I'm wondering is that, you know, for so many years, there have been a lot of teachings on empowerment and on bringing people's spirit out at work. There's been, you know, quite a movement to doing that. And I guess having been away a while and coming back, I was expecting to find that maybe the Western world would have evolved a little bit from before, and yet there seem indications that it's going the other way. I'm wondering what your view is on that and why we have the problems we do.
Do you know a man named Matt Hanbury?
No.
Matt Hanbury. Well, he's Rupert Murdoch's nephew, although quickly add, he's absolutely nothing like Rupert Murdoch.
Yes.
But Murdoch books are Matt Hanbury's. He had Murdoch magazines, which I think he sold, and I worked with him at Murdoch magazines when it was fledgling, and we did servant leadership, and we did Circles of Silence, we did all of this stuff. He was a very enthusiastic supporter, and I think still runs Murdoch Books that way, and he is in other enterprises as well. In Sydney, if you come across Matt Hanbury, you can make a contact and use my name. I consulted for him for, 15 years, and he still calls me every once in a while. But he's a true believer.
Wonderful. Okay, and he's in Australia.
Yes, he's in Sydney.
Okay, good.
And there's also a group in Australia, and I don't know where they're located, but if you email me, I can find the information. It's called Spirituality, Leadership, and Management. The acronym is SLAM. And they hold an annual conference and do a lot of workshops and things on spirituality and management.
Yes, they're a great group. I've been to their...
Oh, so you know them.
I think
okay.
The Greenleaf Center for Servant Leadership has a branch in Australia, too.
Oh, fabulous.
Yeah, I've actually wrote an article which appeared in their magazine, and they were considering me having me as a board member, yeah. So thank you, and appreciate the connections.
You're welcome.
What were your thoughts in terms of the direction of corporate management over the years?
Well, I'll tell you, the recession drove a lot of the corporations that seemed to be loosening up and becoming more people-centered, drove them right back into being more bottom-line-centered. And, of course, being people-centered is not antithetical with bottom line. In fact, I think they work very well together. It's just a lot of top people, particularly men, are scared of it. You know, we don't have time for all that soft stuff now. We got to focus on the bottom line. I've seen a lot of that.
Mm. Okay. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Well, it's time for us to begin to conclude this call, so I have one more question for you, Jim. Would you describe what's going on next for you, and you know, like, what do you see over the horizon for yourself in terms of you being a servant leader and your work in the world?
Well, the horizon gets ever shorter for me. I still do some working with groups. In fact, I've done two or three things in the past few months. Very much on the same line as what I have been doing and giving lectures and workshops on servant leadership. Personally, I've moved more toward things like my Looking Around for God book and Choosing Gratitude, and I'm doing more poetry. I have a daily radio program in which I read poetry. It's a 5 to 7 minute program in the morning, which is repeated a few times during the day. I'm going to do a thing on poetry and spirituality in a series of workshops at my church. So nothing very national in scope, Judy, but things that are very satisfying to me.
Yeah, so beautiful. It's like really nurturing to your spirit and soul. And anybody near you, I think, feels that. I know I do in our conversations. And I appreciate all that you are and all that you're doing, and mostly all that you're being.
Thank you very much. I so look forward to seeing you and being at that conference.
Oh, me too. So let me make a couple of announcements, then I'm going to do a reading from your book, Jim, and then ask you to make the very last closing statement. So my announcements are about the Wisdom at Work conference. If you're planning on attending and haven't registered yet, the registration, early bird registration, is good until August 31st, so it's a good time to get the savings from that. And we're going to continue this series of teleconferences with keynote speakers at the conference, and our next one is September 6th at 3 p.m. Central. That'd be 4 p.m. Eastern, and the call will be with Ted Malik, who's written a number of books, among them Spiritual Enterprise, and he's a research professor at Yale University, and he's also a business owner in terms of a financial investment. So he walks between the worlds quite beautifully. And he's giving, his keynote speech will be on practical wisdom for the workplace, which I think is what we've just been talking about. And so those are a couple of upcoming things. So I'd like to read something from Jim's book, The Servant Leadership. And I've actually lost the page number. I usually put that down, but this is early in the book in chapter 1. Jim writes, "I've said it before, I say it again. Business is about people. Business is of, by, about, and for people. It is ultimately how you are with those people that makes all the difference in whether or not your spirituality finds an expression within the context of your work. This is not about some arbitrary decision, quote, okay, now let's all be spiritual, then we can be happier and more productive that way, unquote. This is not a trick or gimmick. This isn't a technique. It's not even a process. It is a conscious choice about how you choose to be and how you choose to live your life at home as well as at work. I know there's always the risk of sounding too otherworldly, too disconnected from the reality of the workplace when I talk about being versus doing. So let me state clearly my belief that what you do at work is a direct reflection of how you are. If you want to make that connection between your spirituality and your work, then the proof of it, in other people's eyes, is in what you do and the way you choose to do whatever it is, from an appraisal to running a meeting to, yes, even firing someone." So, Jim, again, thank you for being on the call. I turn it over to you for any closing words.
Well, it's my pleasure to be on this call, and what you said there at the end is almost what I would say as my closing words. But this, in addition, this is hard work. I heard Jon Kabat-Zinn one time say, "Consciousness is the hardest work in the universe." And believe me, testing your spirituality in the context of your work and having your behaviors reflect that, it's very hard work. People will say, "Oh, you believe in the soft stuff." And I say, "Well, if you think it's so soft, you should just try it for about 6 months." Much harder than just bossing people around. So, and yet, the results of it not only, I think, pay off, if to use that phrase, in the work that you do and the work that the people do, but also you are within yourself. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Thank you, everybody, for being on the call, and we look forward to having you on the next call, if you can make it, and to seeing some of you at the conference. Take care, everybody.
Thanks, Judy.
Thank you.
Thanks, Judy. Bye.